occurring. Is there a way of resetting that? Do we have to drop the machine for 30 seconds in order to reset that buffer? Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, there's a couple of things that can be done. But once I make the changes, which I'm going to make in a couple of minutes, now that I'm actually at the door of the repeater site, we were going from a system that's running about 5,800 baud, maybe a little slower at times, sometimes a little faster, to something like 20 or 30 megs, and it's going to make a huge difference.
My son, the computer maven, wants to know, is it TCP or UDP? I haven't the biggest idea what that means. Over to you, Eric.
Okay, the control circuitry that says you're going into transmit, that's TCP. The actual audio is UDP.
Christopher said, huh. Okay, that's clear as mud to me. Who's the person who said the word test? And hopefully we've also got John WW2S in the process of coming back to us. But the test person first, go right ahead. Give us your full call and name. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Are the same.
Okay, we are the same. And now we're hearing you come through the machine. A little bit noisy, but give us enough audio and follow with your question, John. WW2S, K2RIW.
Okay, thanks. And thanks for your years of uninterrupted dedication to the service. My question is similar. It's related to the earlier antenna question. But before I go into it, how is it now?
You sound beautiful. Please continue. You're 90% audio, 10% hiss. Sounds good. You got it, John.
Okay, I have a new antenna system. And I'm wondering if I should assume that the new antenna system, which I'm using 75 ohm feed line, which has a 2.5 to 1 SWR without any tuner, is due to the impedance at the transmitter and not the antenna's resonant frequency.
And by the way, John, I've got to give you a correction. I'm listening simultaneously to the machine's output and the machine's input. I'm hearing a little bit of hiss on the input, and that's what I was reporting to you. Your output is dead full quieting. You're working like a charm right now. Okay. When it comes to measuring antenna standing wave ratio, the antenna impedance and any characteristic of the interfacing transmission line is what you measure. Any method, any reasonable method of measuring standing wave ratio in the shack is measuring the standing wave ratio of antenna plus feed line only. The source of your signal could be a 50 ohm source, a 1000 ohm source, a thoroughly reactive source. The source of the signal does not change the VISWR that you measure in the shack by usual VISWR measuring techniques. The usual VISWR measuring techniques recognizes the ratio of the power going forward in your transmission line versus what percentage of that comes back from that transmission line. How much of it then can proceed going further back into the transmitter and re-reflecting forward, that portion does not get measured by the usual technique of using standing wave ratio equipment in the shack. Of course, that doesn't sound crazy. Of course, it sounds crazy. So, the majority of our transmitters are very far from 50 ohms, and yet with proper use of the instrumentation you can lay your hands on. Let me drop this. By proper use of your instrumentation, you can measure the VISWR, but you're measuring the VISWR of the antenna. Almost none of us measure the VISWR of the transmitter. In order to do that, let me think about that. You'd have to measure the amount of power going back toward the transmitter and the amount of power that comes back forward, the phase angle between the two. Probably have to do it in two separate steps. You'd have to do it with a real antenna that's got some VISWR versus a dummy load. You notice that you really do calibrate the impedance of your vector network analyzer when you're putting on, during the calibration procedure, a short, an open, and a perfect 50 ohm dummy load. So by those measurements, you can measure what is the VISWR at the source. 99.9% of the time. None of us are doing that. And to some degree, it doesn't matter until you get into the fine detail of what's going on inside of an antenna tuner and what's going on with the, how the transmitter is behaving under various load conditions. So I wonder if that's a little bit clearer, John. It shouldn't be. There's only 50 ways of understanding VISWR in the interface between a transmitter and an antenna. WW2S, K2IW, you got it, John. You can ask more questions if you like.
Well, I think I'm trying to find out whether or not I should be adjusting the legs of the antenna because I want to adjust it for the best resonance. It's a single band, mono band, one-to-one balun, inverted V, 10-foot high, feed point up there on the balun. But instead, before I bothered to do that, because I was going to ask this question, I'm just using a MFJ Versatuner, MFJ 901, which is super easy to get that SWR of the system from 2.5 down to 1:1, WW2S.
Okay. Your antenna tuner, MFJ 901. What you really want to know, whether or not you should make the antenna longer or shorter, you can easily find that one out, John, by doing a bathtub curve plot. I'm not sure if you're talking about the 80-meter band or the 2-meter band, but in either case, if it was the 80-meter band, you make a VISWR measurement at 3.5, 3.6, 3.7, and so on. If it's the 2-meter band, you make a measurement at 144, 145, 146. When you plot the standing wave ratio versus frequency on a graph, if this is the ideal world, you'll see a bathtub-shaped curve, a U-shaped curve, and the bottom of the U is going to be the center of the band or the favorite frequency where you use most of the time. And if that bottom of the U is too far to the right, it means your antenna is a little bit too short. If it's too far to the left, your antenna is too long. The majority of the time, 90% of the VISWR of an antenna, because it is lengthwise, physical lengthwise, being attuned high or low in frequency. That's where 90% of the VISWR comes from most of the time, in my opinion. Let me drop. And so, adjusting the length to get rid of the reactive component, that's what you're doing. You're hitting resonance. That's your highest priority. Make the antenna resonant. The second highest priority is the resistive component that's left over. If it happens to be 60 ohms and you want to adjust it to 50 ohms and you've got a 1.15 as well because of that, don't lose sleep over that. So length of antenna elements and whether or not the resonance is in the right region that you care about, that's what I think you're caring about most. And that's not a function of what is the impedance of your transmitter. Not much of a function of what's the impedance of your transmission line. It's really a function of is the antenna itself resonant? And if it's not, if the antenna is a little bit high in frequency in tuning, it's going to give you some extra capacitance in its impedance. If it's too low in impedance in tuning, it's going to give you some extra inductance in its apparent impedance. And you're trying to make that reactive component go to zero, and by adjusting length, you can do that. And with the bathtub-shaped curve, it's a blind man going up a hill, you know which way to go. The tilt of your feet tells you which way is uphill. I think you see what's going on here, Joe. WW2S, K2RIW.
That helps. That's really interesting. I think you redefined some of these terms that I've been trying to understand for a while. So, I'm definitely going to do the test, and it would be nice if at some point on 20 meters, I can omit the tuner. Is that something that is a goal? And the name is John, WW2S, back to you.
I want to stop you for a second.
Yeah, stand by, John. Go ahead, Eric.
The
time is 8:13 p.m.
All right. Go ahead, continue. I'm going to stop you again in another minute.
Yeah, you still got to reset that clock another hour. By the way, even most of the broadcast stations, when you look at the guide, the program guide that's transmitted with the digital signal, and you look at the actual program they're transmitting, a high percentage of the broadcast stations today are an hour misset. They'll tell you the program A is going on right now, and reality is program B, because the program knows what hour it's on, but the program guide hasn't been reset. So there's a lot of that jazz going on. Is it desirable to remove an antenna tuner? I say no. If the antenna tuner is of reasonable quality, and if you've done a great job and your antenna is a 1.1 standing wave ratio, when you don't need the antenna tuner, is the antenna tuner hurting you? No. The antenna tuner is one more tuned item, which if you have any harmonics coming out of the transmitter, it's going to be lowering those harmonics. So the potential for TDI, for instance, gets better with an antenna tuner. Even though you're using it with a one-to-one input and output, usual way you adjust that antenna tuner, it is a beautiful bandpass filter. So it's giving you an advantage. Its insertion loss might be a tenth of a dB. No one will never know the difference. So is it desirable to remove it? I say no. Because the day will come, let me drop it. The day will come when you use the other end of the band, where the VISWR of your antenna is higher, and the antenna tuner gives you an immediate way of correcting it. Or in some cases, you can use the same antenna on another band. An 80-meter antenna is going to give you a terrible VISWR on 40 meters. Let's see now. A 40-meter antenna, I believe, gives you a beautiful VISWR on the third harmonic on 21, on the 15-meter band. So, a 40-meter antenna, I think, gives you a beautiful VISWR on the 15-meter band, for instance. Leaving the antenna tuner in there will take the little bit of VISWR that's left over when you go to that triple frequency phenomenon, and now make it good. So leave the antenna tuner in, unless it happens to be brand X with tiny little components and it's got a lot of insertion loss. But the only way your antenna tuner can be losing your power is to turn it into heat, assuming it's shielded. Yeah. If it's a very poorly shielded case, you can be radiating some of it. Very rare. If your antenna tuner runs ice cold, it's giving you no detriment. It's giving you a benefit. I would leave it there, Joe. WW2S, John. WW2S, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay. Yes, that is true. When I adjust different parts of the band, it's very helpful. I did notice the opposite. I happened to notice that my 20-meter inverted V, I was able to tune it on 40. I was surprised because isn't it half the size it's supposed to be?
Yay, verily. Your inverted V on 20 meters probably is like a 70 ohm impedance. Or maybe because of the height above ground and the tilt, maybe it's closer to 50. It doesn't matter. It's minor detail. But if you go to the Brown and Woodward curves, which you can find on either Mike Number 1 or Mike Number 2's website, Mike Number 1 is amateurradio.tangovictor. Mike Number 2 is limarktechnet.com. In either case, you'll find an article by K2RIW on perfect impedance match of a dipole. And there you'll find the Brown and Woodward curves. The length of your wire, of your 20-meter antenna, and the diameter, you go to those curves, it'll tell you what the exact impedance of your antenna is. Now I'm going to make a guess on this one. Let me drop. I'm going to guess that your 20-meter inverted V on 20 meters is a 1.1 VISWR. And maybe it's a 65-ohm impedance. And on 40 meters, that antenna probably is 1,500 ohms of capacitive impedance and probably 8 ohms of resistive impedance. In other words, it probably has a 50-to-1 standing wave ratio. Your particular antenna tuner just happens to have a large enough tuning range, and because of the length of your transmission line, the dot of your impedance on 40 meters fell at some particular place in the Smith chart where your antenna tuner can handle it. So the fact that your antenna tuner could handle it on 40 meters is good news. And under normal circumstances, without that antenna tuner, I guarantee your transmitter would have been unhappy. But I do think that you had a fierce visual. Whenever you go to half the frequency of a dipole, you usually build up an extremely high standing wave ratio. And by way of that Brown and Woodward curve, you can predict exactly where it's going to be. It's not too much rocket science, John. WW2S, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yep, it was a large SWR. In fact, it was over 5, over towards the infinite side. I have that really nice dual needle version. And the capacitor on the transmitter side, the variable air cap, was not as tricky, or what's the word I'm looking for? On the antenna side, the variable cap on that one was much more sensitive to very small adjustments, if that helps. I think it sure makes plenty of sense.
You're seeing exactly what you're supposed to see, John. Whenever you've got an extremely high Q mismatched antenna, that means it's going to change impedance real fast as you move a little bit in frequency. And your antenna tuner is now tuning this very high Q antenna, and the antenna tuner is itself becoming a very high Q filter-like network, impedance-matching network. You will, under those conditions, discover a very small change in QSY of your transmitter. It's going to require you to reset the dials, and you're also going to notice that the setting of the dials is very sensitive. If you've got a very high Q resonant network, like your antenna tuner becomes in that circumstance, you rock that dial 1 degree, and you'll see a substantial change. That's a strong clue. You're a good scientist to recognize that. Had your antenna been a 50-ohm load, you'll find that the setting of the C1 and C2 capacitor, if it was a pi network of an antenna tuner, you'll find out that the tuning is fairly broad. But in your particular circumstance, it became very sharp and sensitive. Glad you recognize that. And when you do run that bathtub curve to find out where you are, come back next week and let us know. WW2S, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to do that because I've never really had such a, as soon as I, it took me 10 minutes to set it up and it was remarkably well, the way it responded on 20. I had immediate QSOs even on sideband with low power, and other guys had towers and 800 watts, etc. The only last question is, should I coil wire at the end of my feed line for my 2-meter antenna to create a balun there, because I have never seen VHF baluns, and if you want to save that for next week, that's fine, but thanks a lot for all your help, and this is WW2S.
Yeah, earlier tonight, you signed in with a fairly weak signal and fairly low audio, and now you've come back with a very strong signal and very good audio. What did you change? And what is the nature of your 2-meter antenna, and what makes you think you might need a balun there? Over to you, John, K2LIW.
I thought you might ask that. Well, it's a dipole. I like dipoles. It's vertical, the 2-meter antenna. It's pretty close to the ground because I haven't raised it up yet. It's a short feed line of the cheap old RG58. And I switched radios from an old Radio Shack to a new Kenwood, and the power probably doubled.
Hey, you went from uncopyable to dead full quieting. That's not just doubling power. Something else happened there. Okay, so if you're feeding a dipole, yes, it would work better if there was a few turns of the coax cable near the dipole, acting as a series RF choke. It loses you no signal, but that series RF choke will It's a poor man's balance, which stops RF energy from going down the outside of the coax cable, and it stops the length of the coax cable being part of the tuning of the dipole. And the dipole itself, I'm going to guess, is either mounted in a higher portion of your house, or on the chimney, or on a tree. And so, what the guys on VHF very frequently discover is that the yuckiest antenna in the world, 50 cents worth of an SO239 connector with pieces of coat hanger wire on it, acting as a quarter wave ground plane, four little wires coming off the base and one wire in the center, and you hang that from the chimney of your house, and you feed it even with lossy RG58 cable. Let me drop. And you bring that lossy RG58 cable down through the house into the shack, which might be in the basement, and maybe that cable is giving you 14 dB of extra loss on 2 meters. I'm picking numbers out of the air. But because the antenna is higher up than the rubber duck antenna on your handy-talkie in the basement, the extra altitude is giving you 30 decibels of more signal in the repeater, even though you've got 14 dB of more loss on the cable. Altitude is really helps on VHF. So anybody who takes a handy-talkie, and if he's not less than a mile from the repeater, and he puts any kind of a yucky antenna in the high portion of the house fed with a piece of cable, and maybe he's even got bullet connectors on each one of the floors of the house in that cable, so he can open up the port connector and connect it to the handy-talkie when he's operating from that particular floor of the house. As you can see, you can have a very handy antenna that no matter where you are in the house, you can connect to it and have very good reception as opposed to the handy-talkie. But the guy with the rubber duck antenna on a handy-talkie, he's in the basement and he's 10 miles from the repeater and he's walking around the basement and he's fading in and fading out when you're trying to talk to him. That can be kind of annoying, and it's a very simple solution, as you can tell. So, apparently you've done something along those lines, Joe. Your particular vertical dipole, out of curiosity, where is it mounted? And how many feet of cable is feeding it? WW2S, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2J.
All right, go ahead, Eric.
Give me a second.
The time is 9:25 p.m.
Going. Give that man a cigar. The clock is now set. So, John, where is your antenna mounted? How many feet of cable is feeding it? You got it, John.
It's not mounted. It's a narrow piece of PVC pipe with a couple of plastic wire wrappers on each side, holding a copper, holding the copper wire in place with an SO239 soldered on it with a crummy old. Let's see, how much of that cable is on this? I think it's I don't know. It's really old stuff. I threw that pretty quick just so I could get something outside. I think it's maybe 25 feet, but I really don't know. Could be less. But I'm definitely going to measure it and coil it. I just don't know how tight the coil should be, how many turns, etc. WW2S.
You got multiple solutions here. You could put some toroid ferrite large beads around the outside of the coax. That's what's actually inside of these balloons. And your piece of PVC pipe that's holding the wire, you still kept a secret as to where that is mounted. Is that outside the house, on the chimney? Is it on the side of the house? And the transmission line. If your transmission line on 2 meters happens to be RG8, and to make a coil out of RG8 is not so easy. To do that on 80 meters is easy. To make a good coil on 2 meters, the RG8 is a little bit bulky. Rough guess. 6-inch diameter. 3 turns, it'll do most of the choking action you want. And you can calculate that. You go to the appropriate chapter of the Radio Amateur's Handbook. There's a formula in there. Let me drop. In the section on impedance matching or reactance calculations, there's a formula in there where you tell it the diameter of your coil the number of turns of your coil and the spacing between the turns, or is it the total length of the coil, it'll tell you exactly how many microhenry that coil. And now, by either the formula, X sub L, inductive reactance equals 2 pi FL, where F is in hertz and L is in henries, or you go to the chart that's there. Once you know the number of microhenries of that coil and the frequency you're operating at, 146 megacycles, you'll know exactly how much reactance that coil is giving you, inductive reactance as a coil. Because it's a 50 ohm coax, you'd like the coil to have a higher reactance compared to 50 ohms. 500 ohms or more of inductive reactance and you're home free. It's a good enough artichoke. Not perfect, but 90 some odd percent of the RF energy will no longer flow down the outside of the coax because it's a 500 ohm impedance as opposed to the 50 ohms in the center, if you know what I mean. So the right number of turns of the right diameter, you can calculate that. It's a good science experiment, and you'll know right away if your coil big enough and if there's enough turns to do the job. And now you know what the job is, John. And once you finish all this procedure, come back and let us know how it turned out. Okay, John wants to say something. Go ahead, John.
Yes, Dick. If he's using RG8, it's similar to LMR400 in diameter, and I found that it's usually 10-inch diameter, 3 to 5 turns, and his problem.
D8, sorry.
Okay, I heard John, KC2WGB, I heard somebody say sorry. Who was the sorry person?
Yeah, that was me again. It's 58, the old crummy stuff from CB days.
Don't worry about it. Altitude is everything. Even though it's RG58, and coiling is going to be very easy. So, how many feet above the ground, where did you put that piece of PVC pipe with the pieces of wire? Over to you, John number 2, WW2S. You got it, John.
Right, I actually haven't raised it or mounted it. It's leaning up against the house. So I don't think I definitely have the center conductor side up, at least, and the shield side down, but it's definitely not grounded or touching anything unless it fell and I'm not aware of it.
Okay, so that's leaning up against the side of the house. Does that mean that the center of that dipole is 10 feet off the ground? And you're in the basement of the house, then give us a few words as to where you are and where it is by comparison. How many feet above the ground is it? WW2S, K2RAW?
Feet point is a few inches above the quarter wave for 2 meters.
Okay. I heard some words. They do not have an answer. I'm asking, your dipole is on this piece of PVC pipe. It is how many feet above the ground? And in altitude, where are you by comparison? Are you in the first floor of the house or the basement? WW2S, K2RAW.
Well, antenna feed point, I'm going to say, is 3 feet, and I am in the basement, and I'm, let's see, I'm really close to it. It's around the corner and out the window.
Very fine, John. Now I've got a three-dimensional picture. So the antenna is a few feet above the ground, outside the house. You're in the basement of the house. And had you been talking to us with a rubber duck, which is maybe what you did in the beginning, I suspect you would be very noisy. Were some of your early transmissions on the rubber duck without that antenna? Over to you, John, W2S, K2RAW.
Earlier, I was using Radio Shack mobile 2-meter monoband, and I think I had low audio reports from this before. It has a pretty cheap-looking, lightweight mic. I think it's only, I'm not sure if it was on high or low power. It may have been low. Which is probably, I don't think the max on that output, it's an HTX 252. I don't think it goes any higher than 25 watts or so. It's pretty small, really small heat sink. So I'm now using a totally different radio. K2RIWWWS.
Okay, so in the very beginning, you were using a Radio Shack monoband antenna. Was that mounted on the handy talkie, or was that Radio Shack monoband antenna, a separate antenna in some other part of the house? Where was the Radio Shack monoband antenna? Over to you, John.
Radio Shack monoband transceiver. Same antenna.
Okay. The transceiver, monoband antenna, transceiver. Was the antenna on the transceiver, or was it connected with a feed line and the antenna was in some other place? I'm trying to find out the altitude of the monoband antenna when you first used it. Over to you, John.
Right, I made no changes to the antenna. I just disconnected the coax from one radio, popped it into the other, and it is definitely a crummy connector, too.
The Radio Shack monoband antenna was how many feet above the ground, the first antenna you used? Was that in the basement with you? Over to you, John.
Right, the Radio Shack brand is on the radio, and the antenna, I made no changes to between the two radio swaps.
Right, fine, John, I've got the picture now. Okay, and I didn't wait for the four beeps, did I? Okay, we're going down the list of people who checked in. We're an hour and a half into our technet, and it's time for the mailbag. And I'll answer any question except an answer on cosmic microwave background radiation measurement. What would you like to talk about tonight, John? I'm having some fun with him. KC2WGB, the man who mails the mailbag, the man who mans the mailbag, among other things. K2RIW, you've got it, John.
Good evening, Dick, Paul, everyone on the net. Pleasure as usual. That question was sent to me by Lou into our queue. They're looking into that and trying to establish a way of receiving that signal. That's why I sent that over to you to be prepared in case Lou was here, but you can still discuss it, and it'll all be recorded, which he can listen to at his leisure. Let me go on to my first question here. Okay, I have a young man here with a small amplifier for HF, and it has a transmitting tube in it that's a 5-volt filament. The transformer, the 5-volt filament winding is dead, so he has another transformer which has a 220 primary, but its output is 6.3 volts. He knows that's too high, and normally the 5-volt tap came out, went to a rectifier bridge, and fed the filaments. His question is, should he make the adjustment to reduce the voltage before the rectifier, after rectification, or should he do it from the primary input? Maybe you could give him some help on that, Dick. It's pretty important to him. He doesn't want to blow the tube. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Yeah, the problem this guy has, John, is he's got too many potential solutions. They're all good. Whether you limit the voltage going into the primary, whether you put a resistor or a reactor in the primary or in the secondary, whether you use a dropping resistor, whether you do it before the rectifier, doesn't matter. As long as the RMS voltage, root mean square voltage, total heating power voltage, ending up at the filament, is 5 volts, then he's going to get maximum performance out of the tube and maximum life out of the tube. So, without a doubt, don't want the tube rated for a 5-volt filament to see 6.3, and you don't want the filament rated for 5 volts to see 4.0. In one case, you'll get too little emission. In the other case, you'll get too little life. So, what method you use for voltage dropping almost doesn't matter. Whenever you're finished doing whatever method you've chosen, if with the right kind of instrumentation, you measure the voltage at the filament, and it's RMS voltage, it's 5.0 volts, that's what the rating is for that tube. The tube will give you maximum life and best performance. So it doesn't matter. Lots of ways of doing it. Step-down transformers, variac, dropping series resistor, input side, output side, before the rectifier, after the rectifier. All of them don't matter very much. 6 to 1, half a dozen to the other, is my opinion. Maybe not everyone's going to agree with that. when I pass it back to you, John. Drag your feet just in case somebody else has been there. And maybe there's another pitfall we don't know about. KC2WGB with some delay for anyone else that wants to join on this one. K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Guess not. Okay, Dick, one recommendation I think would be good. Do you think that he could take a tube like, say, a 5U4, which has a pretty substantial filament, and use that for the load before he puts his tube in to make sure that that voltage is going to be stable and at the right setting? Doing it unloaded might give him a problem. What do you think?
Rob, without a doubt, doing it unloaded is going to give him a problem. Even if it was a perfect 5-volt transformer, and you have no tube there, no transmitting tubes, you might see 5.3 volts. And depending on what method of voltage dropping he uses, a series resistor, a series reactor, with no load, he might see 8 volts, and with the tube there, he's going to see 5 volts. So it's got to be loaded. Now, if he uses as the load the real transmitting tube, and if he does something wrong, and the real voltage that gets there is 6.3 volts. That's not bad, as long as he does it for a brief period of time. You put 6.3 volts to a filament when it's supposed to be 5 volts, and you do it for 30 seconds, nothing bad's going to happen. They're very forgiving. But you put 6.3 volts there for the next 1,000 hours of operation, and you're going to half the life of that tube. So, a brief test. A brief test with the real tube is not very dangerous. Unless he does something really wrong and there's 25 volts going to it, yeah. There it couldn't take it for more than a second. But if he's in the vicinity of 5 volts with the real tube, as high as 6.3, that wouldn't hurt it for a few portions of a minute, if you know what I mean, a few seconds or portions of a minute. So, because your 5U4 tube has a very different filament resistance compared to the real transmitting tube, it's not that good a test. I'd use the real tube, and by way of his calculations of dropping resistor current, IR drop, and so on, he knows what vicinity of voltage he's going to get. So he knows with the real tube there, maybe the real 5-volt tube draws 5 amperes, we'll say. He can predict what he's going to get, and so I would use the real tube as the load. KC2WGB, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. KC2WGB. The only reserve I have on that is there's a thing called filament flash. I'm sure you're familiar with it, and that could be a problem for him. But in any event, I think he should do his calculations and maybe increase the impedance a little bit so he knows he's going to be below, and just see how it behaves, and then move it up from there. And he could do that in very small increments. But, yeah, good recommendation. I think that'll work for him.
Yeah, the filament flash that you worried about, John, that happens if your source of the 5 volt is extremely low impedance, and all incandescent things, light bulbs, filaments, and whatever, have a drastically lower resistance when they're cold. Your 100-watt light bulb, which should draw roughly 1 ampere at 100 volts, therefore it's got very close to 100 ohms of resistance. You get much less than 1/10 of that resistance when the light bulb is cold. So your 100-watt light bulb, at the instant you first turn it on, during the first few milliseconds, it's drawing over 10 amperes. You're putting more than 1,000 watts into it for the first few milliseconds until the filament gets hot. And that's the reason why the filament will eventually develop a narrow spot somewhere, and the day will happen where you turn it on and you hear a pop as that section finally lets go. But normal techniques by which he is likely to take the voltage of his transformer, which naturally wants to be 6.3 if he's feeding it with 220, and he's now going to be lowering it to 5 with some kind of series resistor or series reactor. The good news when he does that is he's raising the apparent source impedance of the 5-volt signal generator, so to speak. Job. As such, he's moving in the direction of a very gentle start on that filament. The higher the impedance of the voltage, feeding an incandescent light bulb, the more gentle is the startup. Very similar to what some guys do in the case of a high voltage power supply that's got a rectifier and capacitor input network. If you happen to turn on the switch at the instant that your power company is putting out peak voltage, and you've got thoroughly uncharged capacitors, the current flowing through those diodes is a fierce number. And so some people will put a startup resistor. In other words, for the first few seconds, there's a series resistor going back to the 110-volt power supply, or maybe on the secondary side of the transformer. In either case, there's a series resistor somewhere to limit the inrush current. So he's going to be limiting the inrush current by most of the techniques by which he's dropping the voltage. So he's going in the desirable direction of treating that filament with tender loving care. KC2WGB, K2IW in the TechNet.
Very good, I agree. I don't think he's going to have a problem with that at all. I don't think he has anything to worry about. Except where he's going to mount the transformer. He has no room, but okay, fun. Let me let it drop and I'll go on to the next one.
N2RQ.
Do you want to pick that up, Dick?
N2RQ, I think that's Lou. Go ahead, Lou.
Okay, I'm on Echolink, and I just wanted John to know I was here. I guess you didn't see me in the list. So I'll be listening. He's got as much information as I could give him.
I think you're saying, Lou, that the person asking that question was somebody that you know that was asking it. Is that true, Lou?
Yeah, I posted it for a couple of kids at Brooklyn Tech who are working on this project. They want to receive this residual signal and somehow use it to as a source to generate a random number series.
Okay, when you say that problem, we were discussing 5-volt filament. I think you're now referring to the cosmic microwave background. Now, to use the cosmic microwave background as a random source of signal to run some kind of a random number generator, why is that better, Lou, than using the pure Gaussian noise you get out of a resistor or any transistorized amplifier that doesn't have a heavy 60-cycle hum going into the voltage? The noise coming out of a transistorized amplifier, right, or just an ordinary receiver, a ham radio receiver or a VHF receiver, having a 50-ohm dummy load at the input, will turn off the squelch. In that IF strip, in that audio output, you've got thoroughly Gaussian distributed random noise. Why would that noise not be good enough? Why would it have to be cosmic microwave background noise of the universe? There's nothing more pure about the CME as opposed to the ordinary noise you get out of an amplifier or out of a resistor. N2RQ, K2RIW, you've got it, Lou.
Okay, first of all, I didn't mean to interrupt. If you still have something on the filament discussion, that's fine. The answer to that question from me is I have no idea. I was just following up on the inquiry that they made of me. These kids came from the physics team to the radio club at Tech and sought my assistance. And I wish I could get them on. Maybe they're listening. I don't know. I did send them the information on how to monitor. They could answer the questions. All I could do is email them or try and meet with them again during the week.
Okay. Likely, Lou, that we're going to flip over to that question in a couple of minutes. And if we don't answer it correctly, the right question, and it has to be posed again next week, not a problem. So let's see what else John's got. John, if you've got another mailbag question you think we should handle, probably do. And if not, after that, we're going to go over to this cosmic microwave background noise measurement, because that one's going to take a while. So let's go to your next mailbag question first, John. KC2WGB, the man with the mailbag. And it's getting heavy. K2RIW, you got it, John.
Okay, Dick. talking about Boyd Blue. Now, the group, if they can get on Echolink, they could send me the question as brief as possible. Just type that in there, and I could forward the questions to you if that's possible. But, okay, I have just two quick ones to cover, and then we can go right over to Lou's question. Let me let it drop. Okay, young man who's studying the Retina Code, and he wants to know, if you know, how did they start with the resistor values? What kind of silliness went on? He says, it doesn't seem to make sense to have things like 270 ohms instead of 300, and where'd they come up? It seems it's arbitrary to him. Maybe you have some information on that, Dick. Back to you, KC2WGB.
It depends on where you start. I might decide to start with my first resistor being 10 ohms, 10.0 ohms. And because my method of measuring resistance could have a certain amount of error to it, and my method by which I produce the resistors is going to have a certain distribution. In other words, my next resistor up the line, I might desire to make it 20 ohms, but because of the way I mix it, it's going to come out somewhere between 18 and 22, so on. So the very early resistors, I think 10 ohms was one of the first resistors, and then in the beginning, the resistors were 20% accuracy. I think they were 20%. So if I increase by 20% from 10, maybe I get 18 ohms and so on, and 22. Those crazy numbers. Start off with some resistor you like, and then increase in steps, fixed steps in percentage. That allows you to come out with those crazy numbers. So now, the 20% accuracy resistors have one set of numbers. The 10% accuracy resistors have a lot finer set of numbers. The 5% accuracy resistors have an even finer set of numbers. You choose all of the numbers that are associated with 5%, 10%, and 20%. Let me drop. And you'll notice that as you go up the line of resistors, they all differ by a fixed amount of percentage of resistance. That's sort of how they came about. You take carbon granules and you grind them up and you put some kind of a glue in there to hold them all together, and you choose the right dimensions and the right mixture, the right recipe, so you think you're going to get a 10 ohm resistor. Well, depending on how careful you are, and you now build a whole lot of them, and you measure their real resistance with good instrumentation, you're going to find a Gaussian distribution where the center of the curve might be at 10 ohms, and then they're going to fall off with that Gaussian distribution. You're going to get a very small number of them at 8 ohms, a larger number of them at 9 ohms, and so on. You're going to draw that Gaussian-shaped curve. That's the normal production run. So wire-wound resistors are done with much higher precision. Carbon granule resistors, usually a lower resistance, a lower precision, and you got to worry about something else with carbon granule resistors. Let me drop. They have a fairly nasty aging characteristic. If your particular resistor is rated for half watt, you're dissipating 0.54 watts into it. Come back a year later and you measure its resistance, you're going to be unhappy with the resistance you're going to measure. It's going to change quite a bit. If it's a half watt rated resistor and you're dissipating 5 milliwatts into it, come back 10 years later, you're still going to see a shift in resistance, nowhere near as bad. But so carbon composition resistors shift slowly in time. If they're being very gently used, they shift much faster in time if they're being abused. And the higher value resistors shift faster. You take a 1 megohm RCO7 half watt carbon composition resistor, 1 megohm, brand new, and you come back in 5 years and measure it, it might measure 500 kilo-ohms. It may change by a 2-to-1 ratio. The higher the resistance, the faster the change. The higher the dissipation, the hotter you run it, the faster the change. So if you want precision resistance, you might not want to use a carbon composition resistor. You might want to use a film resistor, a wire wound resistor, and so on. Each of them have got their advantages and disadvantages. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Comment. KC2WGB. Very true, Dick. The worst part about the carbon resistors is the negative coefficient of the temperature readings. And if they're used near their limit, they do deteriorate and get lower in value pretty quickly, and they usually discolor too. I believe I heard Wesley in there. You want to pick that up, KC2WGB.
You've got it, Wes.
But the concept of basic resistance measurement is kind of straightforward. The source unknown cars account the resistors and measure the voltage drop or place known voltage across the resistor and then measure the current. However, there's methods because of the Ohm's law of voltage equals current times resistance are more difficult when the resistor is under test and is parallel with another resistor or resistance, or when automated test probe becomes contaminated from the particles or solvents. So in either of those camps, some methods of guaranteeing the resistor under the test is required. And I wonder if you have heard about practice known as six-wire measurement. And to experience.
When it comes to measuring resistors in a precise manner, the so-called Kelvin technique of four-wire resistance measurement is considered considerably more accurate than the two-wire method. And so, in the case of the Kelvin four-wire method, you take the outer two wires, so to speak, along the length of the resistor, you pour a known amount of current into those two outer wires, and then the two inner wires closest to the actual resistor, you measure the voltage drop under that current condition, and those two inner wires are measured with a very high impedance voltmeter, which doesn't disturb the system. So the four-wire Kelvin connection allows you to make very precise measurements, and if you've got a resistor that's in a constant current generator circuit, for instance, the four-wire technique is the best way to measure the accuracy of your resistor and therefore what current you're going to get. I haven't heard of the six-wire technique, although I can see that... Let me drop... If this is the best of all worlds, I'd like to be able to measure quality of my resistors while they're in the circuit. But almost all circuits have got other resistors, capacitors, inductors, diodes, transistors, other things around the resistor. Once you've got the schematic of the circuit, sometimes you can put your voltmeter in there with the right polarity of the voltmeter, such that it's back biasing the emitter base junction of the transistor that's sitting there. You've got no power going into the circuit. And if you can choose the right direction of ohmmeter measurement, you can get a fairly accurate measurement of that resistor some of the time by choosing the right polarity. So, and when it comes to measuring the resistor inside of a circuit, what accuracy is required? If you're troubleshooting a circuit where the signal is not flowing through, and if by an approximate technique of measuring the resistor in the circuit, you find out that this thing is supposed to be a 470 ohm resistor, and you measure, because of other things around it, you measure 400 ohms, and you think the other things are not dominant, you're in the right ballpark. That's not the thing that's stopping the signal from flowing through, if you know what I mean. You don't have to have 1% accuracy in that circuit when you're doing that kind of troubleshooting. But there are other kinds of circuits where maybe there's a precision constant current generator somewhere, and it's based on the voltage drop at a certain current flowing through a precision resistor, and now you want to know the exact value of that resistor. That could be difficult. You might have to remove one lead of the resistor from the circuit in order to confirm that accuracy. So, I haven't heard of a six-wire technique, Wes. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, it's very much known technique when you use the Kelvin four wire method or resistance measurements. But sometimes that is even inadequate to be used. So six wire was a very clever idea of national instruments. And they produced the peak CPXI-4072 flex DMM. And in addition to that, they used the LCR meter. So it is a 6.5 digit digital multimeter and LCR meter in one. Unfortunately, cost of close to $3,000, but if you just look for it or you just Google for six wire resistance technique, you're gonna find a very clever schematic that will give you the idea how that is being done. Let me wrap. So the difference between the four wire is that they're trying to prevent the source current from traveling through one of the adjacent resistors, and they use the unity gain operation of the amplifier that is inserted into the circuit. And that one is guarding the resistor on the test. So basically, that is the answer for it. Thank you.
Now, I think I see what's going on here. If the resistor is all by itself, and I connect four wires to it, the two outer wires apply a known amount of current. The two inner wires, closer to the actual resistor element, measure the voltage drop across my unknown resistor, and then by Ohm's law, I know exactly how many ohms I've got. When that unknown resistor is now in a circuit, some of the current I'm trying to apply with my ohm meter is not going through my unknown resistor, it's going through the rest of the circuit, contaminating the measurement. If I have at least one other lead, or maybe two other leads, where I now measure the amount of current leaving my resistor region, flowing to the rest of the circuit, and even though the length of that wire going out there only has a milliohm resistance, but if I can measure the voltage drop in that milliohm accurately, I now know how much current is flowing outside of my resistor, and then with some good mathematics, I can figure out what my resistor is doing. Let me drop. And now by way of an operational amplifier, connected to the outer leads of my unknown resistor, I can produce an ideal voltage, an ideal current, because the plus and minus input lead of an operational amplifier that's being used as a voltage follower or as an inverter acts as the world's best short circuit. Essentially, microvolts or nanovolts of voltage drop will occur between the plus and minus lead of an op amp. So if I properly place those leads in the circuit, there's various ways I can cancel the amount of current that's flowing away from my resistor into the circuit that's contaminating my ohm meter measurement. So I'm beginning to see that that's a very crafty technique for making in-circuit measurements without clipping that resistor out of the circuit. It's a little bit elaborate. In many cases, just opening up one end of the resistor, lifting one lead, is all you've got to do in order to now be able to really measure that resistor. So, would I go through all the rigmarole, would I go through all the rigmarole of setting up a six-wire measurement technique and proper calibration of it, as opposed to just unsoldering one end of the resistor and making the measurement half in the circuit and half out, if you know what I mean? Most of the time, I would choose the second technique. But it's nice to know that there's another way of going. I thank you for bringing that to our attention, Wes. Okay, KC2WGB with the next mailbag question, K2LIW. You've got it, John. And by the way, people can mail questions to you not only by EchoLink. I think they can do it by chat room. Over to you, John.
KC2WGB. That's correct. The chat room also. Forgot to mention that. Okay, let me know, drop go on to the next quick question. All right, this young man has a question on fuses. He has a device that takes a 1.5 amp slow blow fuse. He wants to know if there's any problem with substituting a 2 amp fuse in place of that. Do you think it would be safe to do that?